to do today is, yesterday we derived the first Cartan equation, and I sort of essentially presented you with the second Cartan equation. And I was arguing that this was a very useful calculational tool. So the idea of today's lecture is to demonstrate that by looking at a specific metric. So yesterday was quite abstract, a lot of formalism and sort of developing the formalism. And so today I want you to see it in action. And because there's quite a bit of algebra involved, rather than have you worrying about copying or getting it, you know, accurately from the board, this way you've got the details of the calculation in front of you. So if you kind of, your hand becomes too tired, you can just pause, knowing that you've got everything in front of you. Also, if I make a slip up because of jet lag, you can correct me. So, right. So the idea is, what we're going to do is we're going to calculate the curvature of a static spherically symmetric metric. Now, in the handout, there's a little preamble that actually discusses how you get the particular form of the metric of which we are going to calculate the curvature. And I'm not going to go over that, but I encourage you to take a look at it at some point in your manifest, spare time, which I'm sure you've got loads of. And because it shows how you use symmetries to make simplifications in the form of the metric. So we know that a star is roughly round, so to a very good approximation, it's spherical. And so what that means is that we can sort of rotate around with an SO3 group and it looks the same. So that means that we have an SO3 algebra of Killing vectors. So Killing vectors are things for which the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes. So again, we're covering some of this offline rather than in the lectures, but this beginning bit, I think is quite good to sort of see how you use your intuition of a physical system to simplify the gravitational or the geometry. So, yep, computer squared. So the SO3 symmetry group basically tells you that your angular parts of your metric are simply proportional to that, this d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared is the metric on a unit 2 sphere. So here, we are taking coordinates, theta and phi, to be, in our own intuition, spherical polar coordinates. So that's what our SO3 Killing algebra gives us. It tells us this is the angular part of the metric and there are no cross terms. And then the rest of it is, to some extent, we've kind of gone for broke here, but what we really want is a metric of a star that isn't really changing in time. And so we sort of say, well, obviously the physics is just going to depend on the distance, or a parameter that tells us about the distance from the center of the object, and it's not going to depend on time. So this static bit is what's telling you there's no t dependence in the metric. So this is kind of what we end up with. Now, there's still some freedom in this metric. I don't have to have three independent functions here. I could sort of reduce my degrees of freedom further, but I'm just going to leave it like this for the moment. Because sometimes it's useful to have the flexibility to change your gauge according to the problem that you're solving. Right, so that is our metric. Now we're going to do the Cartan method and calculate the curvature. So have you actually, has anyone at any point calculated a Riemann tensor by going through the Lebesgue-Civita symbols? Yep, so lots of nods, yes. Was it fun? Okay, right. Well, see if you think this is quicker, or at least more efficient. Right, so if you remember, what we're going to do is that we're going to start off by making that simplification. Of finding an orthonormal basis. Remember that the symmetric part of our connection was equal to the exterior derivative of the components of the metric. So if we choose an orthonormal basis, GAB is eta AB is a constant, so D is zero. So our connection one forms are anti-symmetric. So that's what we're first going to do. And this is pretty easy in this case. So sometimes, and I know David is not a fan of this, sometimes I may put hats on my basis in indices just to remind myself that they're orthonormal, but I'll probably just do that right at the end. But remember, this is an orthonormal basis. So if we do this, then you can see that omega t tensor omega t gives us this a squared dt squared. The omega r tensor omega r gives us our b squared dr squared. And then the theta and phi one forms give us the angular part of the metric. So this is our orthonormal covector basis. So now we're going to calculate the connection. I've got quite used to the fact that top one isn't working. So we're using that first structural equation. Our connection is a metric connection. It's torsion free. So d omega plus theta wedge omega vanishes. So if I want to calculate this, I've already constructed that. So I just have to take d to get my connection. So if I start with t, d of omega t is just simply d of a wedge dt, because remember d squared is zero. Which is just dA wedge dt, which is a prime dr wedge dt. So that is a primed over ab omega, well, let me say minus a primed over ab omega t wedge omega r. So I've put all the steps down there. D omega r is zero. because B is a function of R. So if I take D, get nothing. So D omega theta, that's really just like taking D of omega t, but replacing the A with a C. So I can automatically write that down. Just by looking at what I did with the time. And then finally, we need to take D of omega phi, which is the only one that's going to have more going on in it, really. So, is that a question or on the third row? Is there a question there? Might as well ask, because maybe someone else has got the same.
Why is it clear that those forms with those coefficients are orthonormal?
So, right, so essentially what I've done here is I have sort of taken our components of the metric. So if I look at omega A tensor omega B, GAB, that should be my metric G, my symmetric two form. And so what I want is that to be orthonormal. So I want this to be eta AB, right? So if I now ask the question, does it work? So I look at putting an eta AB, so eta TT, I think it says it somewhere, my conventions, this is the first time I've actually had to say this. My conventions are this one. So eta tt is plus one. So that means I get omega t, e to the, so a squared dt squared, et cetera, et cetera. For this block diagonal metric, it's quite easy to take the orthonormal basis because I just take a square root of each coefficient. If you have cross terms, then you might have to think a little harder. But it's usually, at least for most of the metrics that we're interested in, it's possible to find an orthonormal basis. So. Oops, it was worth asking the question, I think. So. Okay, so that's almost everything to calculate the connection. So here, if I just focus on this first one in detail, I've taken D of omega t, and this should be, it's got a yellow piece of chalk, this is supposed to be equal to minus theta tb cross omega b from Cartan's first equation. So if I look at this, what this is telling me, I've only got one term here, omega t cross omega r. So it's telling me that there's only really one non-zero connection one form, and that is theta t r which is a primed on a b omega t. So that's the only connection one form I get here. Similarly, if I look at omega theta, I've only got one term on the right-hand side, so I've only got one thing that I can read off here. So finally, if I look at omega phi, I've now got two terms here. So I expect a phi r and then I expect a phi theta . Now let me just pause a moment, because I said when I was looking at this d omega theta there was only one term on the right hand side, so maybe there was only one non-zero connection one form with with a theta index, and here I've got a phi theta. So let me just make sure. If I go back to this expression here, theta AB cross omega B, and put in my theta coordinate, theta phi cross omega phi is going to be proportional to omega phi cross omega phi, which is zero. So this term doesn't mess up my d omega theta. So I'm finished now. I've calculated the connection. Those are the connection coefficients in this basis. So now let's try the curvature. So my curvature, I have to calculate those curvature two forms. So I do that by taking d theta plus theta wedge theta. So we're in four dimensions, and our RAB is antisymmetric. So we've only really got to calculate six of these. So let's start with the T ones. So if I do RTR, so I'm just sort of replacing that A index with a T, and what I see is that here the only non-zero connection one form with a T component has an R index. But then that would mean that this C index was an R, and so it's zero because we know our connection forms are antisymmetric. So it's just the first term. So that is D of, well, theta TR is A primed on AB omega T. So I'm just going to write it like this. So that is my first connection, sorry, my first curvature two form. So RT theta, there's going to be no connection one form with T theta indices. So here, I'm only going to pick up terms coming from the cross products. And the only non-zero component is TR, so this is what I've got. Now, the only slight wrinkle here is that what we calculated was theta, was with the theta index up and the R index down, and what we want is the connection one form with the R index up and the theta index down. So just with a brief aside, So if I want to, what I have to do is I want to raise the theta index, lower the R index, and swap the order. Each of those processes gives me a minus sign. So that's three minus signs overall. And so this coefficient here is actually minus what we calculated over there. So theta TR is A primed on AB, omega T, sorry, T theta, and so that's my T theta 2 form. So you do the same thing essentially for the phi. All right, I'm going to pause here because I'm halfway through calculating the curvature and I've just been sort of turning the handle a bit here. So is it sort of clear, the procedure or the process? More or less. Okay, well, let me just finish the job off since I'm almost there. So if I now want to, I've done everything with a T in it in my curvature two forms. So now to finish off, I just have to do the theta R, phi R, and phi theta. So you always have to just make sure you don't get any contributions from the theta wedge theta term. Here, what are the non-zero components? Well, A, we've got theta R, but then that would be an RR index, and it's anti-symmetric, so that would be zero. Or I could have a theta phi and a phi R, but my theta phi and phi R both are proportional to omega phi. So they both give me zero. So I've checked that that term does not contribute. So all I have now is D of this one form here, which runs through in a very similar fashion. To what happened with the T in the T component, TR component. So we're nearly there, yeah. Well, they're only actually a set of simultaneous equations. So here you're doing differentiation. So that's where you kind of do a little bit of work. But once you've got that, you know, this is, in our case, it's a set of four equations. And each of, you know, in each case, each of these omegas, you know, you kind of, they are a geometric object, right? The omega is a geometric object. So, you know, once you've got your d omega A, in this case, d omega T just has omega T cross omega R. So you know that the only things that you can have here are something this could be an omega t or it could be an omega r. And I suppose, actually, that's probably a good question, because what I've actually done here is what I've been a little bit quick about is the fact that because d omega r is zero, I kind of know that there's no omega r term sitting inside this connection one form. So I've sort of been a little bit glib in this derivation. In general, there could have been an omega r sitting in there crossed with an omega t. No, they couldn't, because then that would be tt. Anyway, yeah. So all it is actually just a set of simultaneous equations. It's an algebraic problem once you've done that exterior differentiation. So you find the solution. Nearly done. So in this case, I do actually get a cross term because my theta phi theta is proportional to omega phi and the theta r is proportional to omega theta. So here, just substituting in the expressions for everything, that's what I get. And so when I take this derivative here, my first term is the r derivative. The second term takes the derivative of with respect to theta. But now if you look carefully, if you replace what omega phi and omega theta are in terms of d theta and d phi, you see that these two terms are the same, except one is d theta cross d phi and the other is d phi cross d theta. So they're the same but opposite signs, so those cancel. And so what I'm left with is something that looks exactly the same as the theta r component. So the last actual calculation that has to be done is just finding out what the pure angular two form is. So here, theta phi theta is just cos theta d phi. And then I get a cross term. So if I take this is minus sine theta d theta cross d phi. Okay, so sorry, I had to sort of just sit there and or do the calculation, but here what we've done is we've simply taken the derivative here. I've substituted in d theta is omega theta over c, d phi is omega phi over c sine theta, so that gives this 1 over c squared. And so what I've now got with putting all of that together is I've now finished calculating the curvature of this metric. So it might not be obvious because you're probably more used to seeing it in terms of the Riemann tensor, you know, with all the indices, but this contains all the same information because the curvature 2 form was simply the Riemann tensor with kind of the last two indices mopped up with one forms. So let's just extract the components from this. So remember, this was our definition of the curvature 2 form. So let's just look at that expression and see if we can just pick out what those components are. And at this point, we have to remember that we're in the orthonormal basis. So if I look at my first curvature 2 form, the TR, my RTR just has omega R cross omega T in it. So that tells me, so I'll put the hats on to remind us we're in an orthonormal basis. So our TR, RT, is just the A primed over B all primed. And then we have to divide by 1 on AB because that's our, to get to our omega, R cross omega T. So, T theta. So again, the T theta component has only omega T cross omega theta in it. So there's just one. This is just the only part of the Riemann tensor that is vanishing with the first two indices of T and theta. And you see that that's actually the same as replacing theta with phi. So that's all the Riemann components with a T index. So again, from the far left-hand side of that top board, I can read off the theta R Riemann components. And I can see that's going to be the same as with theta replaced by phi. And then the last one, is just the pure angular Riemann. So those are the only non-zero Riemann components in my orthonormal basis. So we really have calculated Riemann. So to get to the coordinate basis, remember our orthonormal basis we wrote down over here. So our orthonormal basis all we have to do is rewrite our orthonormal basis in terms of the coordinate basis in order to transform these Riemann tensor components into the coordinate basis, which is what you're familiar with. And so for every single basis, covector basis element, I can write it in terms of components with respect to the coordinate basis. And in our case, this is very simple. So, for example, our omega t is simply a dt. So our omega t mu is just equal to a times delta t mu. So all we do, every time we see a t, we either divide by a or multiply by a, depending on whether it's upstairs or downstairs. And whenever we see something with the indices downstairs, then we have to got myself in a loop here. So we have to divide, in this case. Is it divide or multiply, David? Because I think it's multiply when the indices are downstairs by that the relevant factor. Yes, multiply. So that's how we get our coordinate basis. We simply look at, we multiply by the appropriate sort of factors of A, B, or C. So I think why I wanted to go through this with you was so that you could actually just, it is a bit pedestrian, it's a bit pedantic, it's very much turning the handle, but what it enables you to do is to sort of see the process of involved in calculating a curvature and the fact that it's actually not that bad. So one of the problems that you have if you're using that standard relation in terms of the Riemann coordinate components from the Levi-Civita symbols, you're usually contracting over an index in the gamma-gamma term, and it can be quite easy to forget one of those coefficients. So it can be quite easy to drop terms. And it's also, there's a lot more going on. Whereas here, the differentiation part is very easy. You're just doing, you're sort of somehow, because you're doing it in the basis, you're sort of carrying a lot of the indices with you as you go. So it's a process that has fewer steps, so therefore there's fewer chances of making errors, and it's also just a bit quicker. So let's look at what we've got now in terms of our curvature tensor. So I'm just going to write down what the coordinate basis now is. So what happens is you start to sort of see patterns emerge, and what you notice is that the components, the angular components, the Riemann is the same, and that actually it has to be the same because of spherical symmetry. So you know, if there was a difference between, you know, the theta and phi components of a curvature tensor, that would be saying that, if you like, the tidal forces were different, and so there was something distinguishable between those angular components. And that can't be, because the idea is that no matter how we rotate or turn our sphere, the space-time looks the same. So if you'd gone through this calculation and you'd found something different for theta, theta, and phi, phi terms, that would be a clue that you'd gone wrong somewhere. So to get our Ricci tensor, which is what we need if we're actually finding a physical system, we just take the trace of the Riemann. Those are our Ricci components. So the reason that we wanted to look at this space-time is because we're thinking that that metric or this geometry might have something to do with the geometry around a star or an isolated system like planet, black hole. So at the moment, we've still got a little bit too much generality. So let's think about gauge. We don't need all the three functions A, B, and C. So you will be used to what we call the area gauge, which is to say that the area of a two-sphere is 4 pi r squared. So in other words, C equals r. So that's a very common gauge that we use when we're talking about astrophysical objects. But it's only a legitimate gauge if C primed is never zero or negative, because we're saying that we, you know, we have a sort of general C of R, but we're replacing that C with a parameter that's we're associating with a radius. So if our C of R function turned around, then that would not be a legitimate thing to do. So that is true for all normal or known forms of matter, but it does depend on an assumption of an energy condition. So it's perfectly fine for astrophysics, but sometimes in some sort of like more complicated theories of gravity, that might not be the case. So if C were not to be monotonic as we moved in, let's think what that would mean. So C is telling us about the area of spheres. So what that would mean is as we move towards our object, the area would be shrinking and then it would start growing again. So that would be a bit like sort of almost wormhole-y type of behavior. So we would have a sort of a neck and then it would go out again. So we just have to sometimes think what these functions mean. So this area gauge is good for astrophysics and good for most normal stuff. Something else you might want to do, if B is 1, then R is proper distance. So that's something you might want to do. Usually it's not a very practical gauge, but maybe you'd want to do that. Something else you can do is to take C equals RB, and then this is so-called homogeneous gauge. And what that would then mean is that the spatial part of the metric would be B squared times the flat metric. So that's another example. So sometimes you use that expression when you're looking at asymptotic properties because you want to compare what you've got to a flat space time and you want to sort of identify the way things fall off at infinity. So these are sort of some different gauges. So it's just really to get across the idea, you know, we all sort of think, oh yes, spherically symmetric metric. We automatically put R squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. But that's not necessarily, you know, the only thing that you can do that's actually useful to do. So let's take the area gauge. That's the familiar one. So if I find my Einstein tensor, so I just take my Ricci, trace it, and then take RTT minus a half R, this is what I get, and that goes to, in the area gauge, it simplifies quite a lot because if C is R, C double primed is 0, and C primed is 1. So that is now just simply a differential equation for the B function, and it's a really easy differential equation for the B function because it's just a first order equation. So we can integrate it quite straightforwardly. So what we get is that our b function, or 1 over b squared, is just the integral of t naught naught. Now, if we kind of think about this in a weak field limit, t naught naught is just like the energy contained, or energy density. 4 pi r squared is this 4 pi is simply the integral. This is basically the integral of d3x of rho in polar coordinates. So what that integral actually is, we can think of it as being, is just a mass function. Now, of course, we have to be careful with energy and general relativity, but at least in the weak field limit, we've got this identification is, you know, sort of completely reasonable. And even if we're not in the weak field limit, we can still call that integral m of r if t naught naught is not zero. So that's the general solution, even in the presence of matter. If there's no matter, then we have an integration constant. And we have that b squared is 1 over 1 minus 2gm on r. We also, if we look at our GRR, so if we're in vacuum, we can integrate up completely, and we find that our A function is essentially 1 over B. And so this is the Schwarzschild solution. So this is our prototypical black hole solution. I'm sure you've already met it. So I think what's curious with general relativity is like two of the most important solutions from a sort of astro or cosmological perspective, which is the black hole and an inflationary universe or an de Sitter universe, were both found within a year or so of Einstein publishing his theory of general relativity. So it's kind of, you know, those guys were really quick off the mark in terms of getting the important papers out.
It's almost a symmetry picture.
Yeah? No, I mean, I guess for people who, well, I mean, Schwarzschild, this guy did this from the Russian front or something beggars belief a bit, how you would be sitting calculating, you know, while all is going to hell around you. But so it was Weyl did all of his
Levi-Civita,
right? Wow. Yeah. Well, I guess if they were, since the connection has got Levi, you know, the name Levi-Civita, then presumably these guys were fairly au fait with calculating curvatures, because physicists were just, I think, freaked by it at the time, right? took, well, not years, decades for GR to be accepted. So just to finish off, anyway, this is the vacuum solution. So what happens if you have matter? Let's just suppose we have a density profile and a pressure profile. We'll say it's isotropic. Then this right-hand side here of this GRR equation would now instead be 8 pi GP. So we'd actually have a pressure in there. And so what we would... So what we get, instead of a nice sort of the simple vacuum equation, we've got a relation between the gradient of our time component of our metric and the pressure function, as well as this mass function. So our solution for B is still the same as it was, because that we derived that by taking an arbitrary T naught naught. But what we don't have anymore is that GTT is 1 over GRR. So we've also got our conservation of energy momentum. Now, I've only really, strictly speaking, calculated the connection in the orthonormal basis, so we'll have to do this in the orthonormal basis. So I simply take my connection one forms and take a step back to get the components in the orthonormal basis. And this first term is just P primed over B. So it's just, remember, we get our factors of A, B, or C in terms of going between our orthonormal basis and coordinates. Here, that sum, I've just got to sum over the TT, theta, theta, phi, phi. So that's those pieces. For A and B equal to T, I get a rho term. And then theta and phi. So notice there's no gamma, R hat, on the orthonormal basis. I hope you can tell the difference between my P's and rows. I've tried to make my sort of rows more continuously curly and the P's with a sharper... this is my... conservation of energy momentum. So because I know what A primed on A is from the are our Einstein equation. If I make an assumption about my density profile, I can solve for m of r. So I've got explicitly a primed on a. I've also got explicitly my b function. So I can solve that conservation of energy momentum equation for p. So for a given rho, so that's the sort of idea of what we're going to do. So if we take a very simple distribution, so-called top hat, where we simply have a constant energy density inside some radius and vacuum outside the radius, then m of r sort of grows inside the star, and is constant outside the star, and just is the mass of the star. So this is what the conservation of energy momentum equation boils down to. We're kind of, you can sort of see where it's, we've used the expression for A primed on A. And if I put in the expression for M of R, I get my differential equation for P. So these equations of motion known as the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff system, and this is really what's giving us the profile of our sort of very simplified star. So I always sort of say, you know, respect to these guys for finding these solutions. So you can check that this is indeed our solution for P. So the boundary condition that we've applied is that the pressure goes to zero at the outside of the star, because that's the only thing that makes sense by continuity. But what we notice is that the pressure at the center of the star actually, because of the presence of this 3 in the bottom line, we can't just take our star to be as big as we want. So there's kind of a critical limit at which the central pressure tends to infinity. So this is a very simplified example of something that, you know, we've said it's a top hat density, we've, you know, assumed everything's isotropic. But this is this very simple example of what we would call the Chandrasekhar limit now, which is this concept that you can't just keep on piling more and more mass onto a star. Eventually it will collapse. So, as you know, if a star gets too heavy, there's no laws of physics that will stop it from collapsing, and it forms a black hole. So in this case, we're not seeing any dynamical process. We're not seeing it form a black hole. All we're seeing is an inconsistency in this particular example. So when Tolman, Oppenheimer, and Volkoff first found these solutions, they would have just noticed, but, you know, you've got this infinity. This is showing that we've gone beyond our simple approximation of a constant energy density. And in fact, as soon as the pressure were to come above the energy density, you'd get worried before you reached infinity at this core. You'd get worried once the pressure became equal to the energy density. So that would tell you had a sort of stiff equation of state, which is again something that's quite hard to achieve. So this is sort of a very simple argument, but it's sort of indicative of a far deeper sort of physical property, which is that there is a limit to how much matter you can squeeze into a finite space before you form a black hole. So I've overrun, so I better stop there.